Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Stephanie, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's workshop, Update on Chronic Lymphocytic Leukemia. And today's Connect workshop is a collaborative effort between the Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care. And it really is because of that collaboration we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. We also are collaborating with a number of other cancer organizations as well. And so we have on the program today over 615 participants, and you come from all of the United States, from all different regions and states in this country. And we also have international participants from Australia, Brazil, Canada, the United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So you really come from all over the world, and it's a credit to you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. This program today is supported through unrestricted educational grants to the Lymphoma Research Foundation from Genentech Biooncology, Biogen IDEC, and Gilead Sciences, and I really want to thank them for their support of this program. And I particularly want to thank the Lymphoma Research Foundation as well for really helping to help with the whole structure of this program today with our selection of speakers and topics. So I really want to thank them as well. Now, I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. And in those materials, you receive them either electronically or you receive them by mail. There is information about our speakers, the topics that they'll be covering, and there also is information about our collaborating organizations as resources for each of you to contact. Those are free resources. And there's an evaluation form. I'm going to ask you all to take a moment and complete that evaluation form at the end of today's program. Your evaluations really help us to choose topics that are most relevant to meet your needs. So please tell us what you want us to do. And, you know, we're planning a lot of programs for 2014 and actually through the rest of this year. And so your feedback really, really helps us to keep the programs fresh and alive and most helpful to all of you. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker, and our first speaker is Dr. Bruce Chesson. And Dr. Chesson is Professor of Medicine, Head of Hematology, Deputy Chief Division of Hematology Oncology, Fellowship Program Director, Georgetown University Hospital, Lombardi Comprehensive Cancer Center. And Dr. Chesson is going to provide an overview of chronic lymphocytic leukemia, current treatment options, and new and emerging treatment approaches. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Chesson.
Thank you. Chronic lymphocytic leukemia is the most common form of leukemia in Western countries, and we have about 15,000 to 16,000 new cases in the U.S. every year, which means there are probably hundreds of thousands of people walking around with this disease because, fortunately, they tend to live a long time. Most patients are diagnosed incidentally. They go in for their routine physical examination, and they come out with leukemia. And they have no symptoms, no signs of the disease, just an elevated lymphocyte count or lymphocytosis. Some patients, on the other hand, present with enlarged lymph nodes, symptoms of an enlarged spleen, or symptoms referable to abnormalities in the blood count, such as a low red blood cell count or anemia. Not everybody with chronic lymphocytic leukemia needs to be treated at the time the diagnosis is made. And the diagnosis is made primarily on the basis of blood counts. You generally do not need to have a bone marrow biopsy to make the diagnosis or a lymph node biopsy because all the relevant tests can be done on the peripheral blood. But as I said, not everybody needs to be treated. And about half the patients we just watch for months or years in what's called watch and wait or watch and worry, depending which side of the stethoscope you're on. Why don't we treat patients initially? Well, all treatments have side effects. They have expense. They have inconvenience. And there have been several clinical trials in which patients who don't have indications for treatments are randomly allocated to chemotherapy or watch and wait, and the survival has been identical. Because once you need to be treated, you get to be treated. And the indications for treatment include such features as disease-related symptoms, fevers, chills, drenching night sweats, profound fatigue, unexplained weight loss. They include enlarged or progressively enlarging lymph nodes, liver or spleen, anemia or a low platelet count called thrombocytopenia, recurrent infections, and those sorts of features. And when they occur, the discussion starts between the doctor and the patient that it seems like it's about time that we start treatment. It's not common that it's an emergent decision. You generally have time to get used to the idea that treatment is coming, to learn about the various treatment options, which is critical because things are really changing rapidly right now in the field of CLL. We have a number of prognostic factors that we also look at in patients with CLL. Probably the most predictive, or at least prognostic of these, are chromosome analyses done by a test called FISH, or fluorescent in situ hybridization. This allows us to get a good idea about whether there are chromosomal abnormalities in the leukemia cells, not in the patient themselves. This is an acquired chromosome abnormality, and about 80% of patients will have something. Some of these are good, such as what's called a 13q deletion, and some of these are bad, such as a 17p deletion. There are other tests that are done, such as CD38, a measurement on the cell, ZAP70, gene mutational status, and some newer ones called NOTCH1 and others. These do not tell us whether you need to be treated or not. These give us a rough estimate of what your outcome is likely to be, but they are not predictive in everybody. We have patients who have bad features who live for years and do fine, and others with good features who don't do quite as well. So we don't do them in everybody because they're expensive and they don't necessarily guide what we do, at least when the patient shows up in our clinic the first time. But I know patients want these done because they hear about them all the time, so we can do them. So when the decision is made that a patient needs treatment, what should be the consideration? Well, first is whether there is a clinical trial that might be available. Clinical trials are important because without them, we don't make progress towards improving patient outcome and a potential cure of this disease. In these clinical trials, particularly in the newly diagnosed patient, there are rarely placebos. Patients get their treatment, they get appropriate treatment, and they're followed very, very carefully. The protocols have gone through numerous layers of evaluation, scrutiny, and approval to make sure they're safe, feasible, and that the question is important. For frontline treatment, there are currently two generally used approaches. One is the FCR regimen, fludarabine, cyclophosphamide, and rituximab, and the other is BR, or bendamustine and rituximab. In published papers, the two appear to be comparable in efficacy, and the BR may be a bit less toxic, particularly for older patients and those with comorbidities, meaning heart, lung, liver, kidney disease, and the like. The two regimens have been compared in a very large study by the German CLL study group. The results are not yet available, but I hope we will be seeing them sometime in the next few months so we know better which patients might benefit most from one regimen or the other regimen. But those are chemotherapy regimens, and we are now in a position to start considering the possibility of getting rid of chemotherapy for patients with CLL, at least most of them, because we have a growing number of exciting new treatment options. And these affect different parts of the leukemia cell. For example, there are monoclonal antibodies which bind to a protein on the cell surface like a lock in a key, or a key in a lock, I should say. And they activate certain death pathways within the cell that kill the cell. These affect the outside of the cell. There are other drugs, such as one called Revlimid or lenalidomide, that affect the microenvironment, which is where the cells live. It is what gives them their sustenance. It feeds them. And most exciting has been a new generation of agents that work on the innards of the cell, the pathways in the cell that keep the cells alive, that immortalize the cells. There is a protein on the surface of the cell called the B-cell receptor, or BCR. And when this is triggered through one of many ways, these pathways are activated. And some of these pathways are called BTK or Bruton's tyrosine kinase, SYK or spleen tyrosine kinase or SYK, PI3K, and there are a number of others. And we now have several drugs which impact those pathways, inhibit them, and kill the cells. One that Dr. K will be talking about in more detail is called ibrutinib. It used to be called PCI-32765. Fortunately, it's now called ibrutinib. And this drug affects the Bruton's tyrosine kinase, and he'll talk more about this. Very, very exciting drug. There's another one called idelalisib. Used to be Cal-101, then GS-1101. And this one affects the PI3 kinase. And in patients with chronic lymphocytic leukemia, these drugs are important because they are very active, getting responses in 50, 60, 70% of patients, even those with poor prognostic features. These responses can be durable, and these are pills. So no more intravenous injections, except when they're combined with rituximab. The pills, unfortunately, have to be taken either once or twice a day, depending on the drug, and probably as long as they work, and they will be very expensive. That's the real downside. There are other related drugs in the pipeline that target either SYK, PI3K, or Bruton's tyrosine kinase. They are being developed to make them even more effective against these targets than the ones that we have currently available. What we learned about CLL cells in 1960 by a fellow named Bill Damaschek, who was one of the founders of hematology, was that CLL is not a lymphoproliferative disease. The cells aren't rapidly turning over and growing out of control. It's a lymphoaccumulative disease. The cells just don't die. They accumulate. And there is a trigger within normal cells called apoptosis, and this is programmed cell death. After a certain number of divisions, a cell just naturally dies, except in CLL and in some other malignancies where this program is broken, and the cells therefore accumulate. They accumulate in the blood. They accumulate in lymph nodes. They accumulate in the spleen and elsewhere, causing the disease chronic lymphocytic leukemia. We have a drug which targets this pathway called, there are several of them, the one currently being studied is called ABT-199. And it targets a pathway, a protein in this pathway called BCL2. And it's specific for that particular target. And again, it's a pill, and it is very effective in CLL, even in those patients with the 17p deletion. So we have an exciting new menu of drugs out there in clinical trials, some of which may be available outside of clinical trials because they will be approved by the FDA, hopefully, in the next few months, and therefore be available at your local oncologist. But still, clinical trials are the way we are making progress using these drugs. Now, a question has occasionally been asked. What is the difference between CLL and lymphoma? Well, CLL is actually a form of lymphoma, and it can be quite confusing. There is another entity called small lymphocytic lymphoma, or SLL. The cells are the same, except one has more cells swimming around in the bloodstream, that would be CLL, and one, the cells are more prominent in the lymph nodes. So because they are so similar and because we treat them the same and the prognosis is very similar, we tend to call this CLL-SLL. The cutoff is 5,000 lymphocytes in the bloodstream, which is very arbitrary. And some patients go from 6,000 one time to 4,800 the next. They're not going from CLL to not CLL. It's just the same disease. And then there's another entity of MLUS, or monoclonal lymphocytosis of undetermined significance, which can occur in normal people, and occasionally, but not often, can progress to CLL. And when it does, it is treated as I've been discussing. So I was given 13 minutes, and the barking sound was that my timer showed that it was exactly 13 minutes. So I will turn this back over to Dr. Messner.
Thank you very much, Dr. Chesson. That was a wonderful presentation, a wonderful overview for everybody. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Neil Kay. And Dr. Kay is Professor of Medicine, Department of Hematology, Mayo Clinic. And Dr. Kay is going to address clinical trial updates, managing symptoms, side effects, and quality of life, and the importance of communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Kay.
Thank you. As Dr. Chesson said, I will review in some more detail a recent report on the use of ibrutinib, or the BTK inhibitor, for patients in relapsed CLL. And I do this because this has received a lot of press, and I think more detail on this would be appropriate for this audience. So as Dr. Chesson pointed out, the ibrutinib does target a specific component within the B-cell receptor. It is this is an oral drug, and that was tested in what is called a phase 1b-2 multicenter study, and essentially it was to look at safety, efficacy, some of what's called pharmacokinetics and so on of this drug, and really is a first-in-class oral inhibitor for treatment of CLL. In this case, the patients who were eligible were patients who had had prior treatment and were relapsed or refractory, and they could be CLL or SLL. In this case, the patients got two doses of this oral drug, either 420 milligrams or 840 milligrams. And in general, the toxicity of this was tolerable. Importantly, it was grade 1 or 2, which is the least severe. And these were non-marrow-related, non-immunosuppressive, which is important because it does not overlap then with the more traditional approaches such as chemoimmunotherapy. However, these complications did include diarrhea, fatigue, and infections. And there's some additional complications that I'll mention in a moment that have emerged more recently. The important clinical outcomes for this were that in a very highly refractory group of patients, there was an overall response of 71%. And this lasted, had been lasting at the time of this publication in the New England Journal, which was this year, at over 90% at 26 months, with a rate of overall survivorship over 80%. And this is very, very important news because this is quite different from our usual approaches in relapsed refractory CLL. The additional complications that I will mention that are somewhat worrisome are that an unusual, more rapid evolution of cataract has been reported. In addition, there is a contraindication to using this drug if patients are on anticoagulants because of the risk of intracranial hemorrhage. So I think I will leave that part, that particular component now, and I'm sure there'll be questions about that. I would like to now turn to supportive care. And we believe that this is an extremely important aspect for CLL patients and one that we emphasize in our clinic. We basically define supportive care as what you need to know in order to live a healthier life with CLL. We recognize it's diverse and varies over time, but surely encompasses physical, psychological, spiritual, economic, aspects and need for information and communication. Our overall CLL supportive care guidelines include age-appropriate cancer screening and health maintenance, especially in early-stage patients, and it's important to recognize that second cancers tend to behave more aggressively in patients with CLL, regardless of the type of cancer. We are concerned about immunizations, particularly recommendations for pneumovax and influenza, but it is important to point out that CLL patients need to avoid live attenuated vaccines, such as are present in the shingles vaccine approach. While this is different for different patients, we do currently recommend a set of immunizations for patients who have not yet received immunizations, and that includes the use of pneumococcal vaccination, PCV13 or Prevnar, Haemophilus influenza type B conjugate one dose, a meningococcal polysaccharide could be considered and repeated every 3 years, and for certain patients, pertussis tetanus booster, as well as an annual flu vaccine. There is now a high-dose vaccine, but importantly, there's no real data to suggest that the high dose is any more efficacious than the low dose. The other important point about vaccination is that in general for CLL patients, there is a suboptimal response to any and all vaccinations. However, we still recommend that, believing that it does give a layer of protection over and above that of not receiving it at all. With respect to healthy living, we do emphasize that patients should be at a healthy weight. Regular exercise should definitely be considered so that one is as fit as possible. We do I will comment on green tea extract in a moment, and we also recommend vitamin D. With respect to the green tea extract, we have conducted and published several trials now, which are phase two, that have shown that in a select group of CLL patients, receiving what we know to be epigallocatechin at appropriate doses can, in fact, reduce the total lymphocyte count and lymph nodes. These are not complete responses. They're typically partial, but they can be seen in early-stage patients who otherwise would not be treated. Many of our patients are actually on over-the-counter products, and we can talk more about that in the Q&A. With respect to vitamin D, we have now found and also published that patients with CLL who have suboptimal vitamin D levels and who are then followed over time have a reduced time to first treatment compared to CLL patients who are vitamin D replete. And there are some important issues here. There are definitely controversies about what is an optimal and normal range for vitamin D, but typically it's anywhere from 25 to 80 nanograms per ml. The repletion of vitamin D has yet to be shown to result in a difference. However, we are currently conducting a vitamin D trial to look at that. Our original observation has now been validated by a subsequent publication from Italian investigators where they've also shown that vitamin D insufficiency in CLL patients predicts time to first treatment. I would like to now turn to skin cancer prevention. This is an extremely important aspect and one that unfortunately is sometimes neglected. So we do know that skin cancer risk in CLL patients is twice that of the general population. It tends to be more common in males with CLL, but it is independent of the rise stage and probably is independent of the aggressiveness of the CLL as we measure it. Definitely is seen more commonly as patients age. Clearly is related to complexion and the climate, obviously, for individuals who are living in sunnier climates. And for individuals who've had extensive sun exposure and even sunburns before the age of 20, that can be a risk factor. Other important aspects include family history of skin cancer, where if there is a markedly increased incidence of family history, there tends to be an increased rate for that patient. The types of skin cancers that we see include basal cell, squamous cell, and even a melanoma. What we currently recommend is that CLL patients see a dermatologist who is aware of this complication and who would conduct a full skin exam. In addition, we do recommend extensive and frequent use of UV radiation protection using sunblock of at least 50 SPF. And obviously avoiding high levels of exposure to strong sunlight, which unfortunately doesn't make too many people happy, because that's typically between the ages of, between the times of 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. and 2 p.m. There are there are approaches to extensive skin cancer treatment in CLL patients, but these tend to be controversial and are not necessarily recommended. I would now like to turn to infection. This is a common problem for CLL patients even without therapy. We believe, and perhaps I'll state this as most glibly, an impaired immune system. We know that there are key defects that can occur. The issue is do occur in CLL patients, but how to correct these is unclear. One out of three CLL patients will have at least one serious infection during their clinical course, and many patients have much more common bacterial infections, and these do tend to increase with duration of illness and the treatment course. One common and relatively accepted link to the infection is hypogammaglobulinemia, or low serum immunoglobulins in the plasma or serum of CLL patients. These can be measured, and if in fact they are low, where IgG, IgA, and IgM are all low, the use of intravenous immunoglobulin can be used. That also is somewhat controversial. Of course, it does require intravenous approach, so that is not necessarily the easiest thing to undergo, but typically for patients who are low in serum immunoglobulin and do have recurrent bacterial infections, that is recommended. Prophylactic antibiotics, we do not routinely recommend, but certainly for patients who have been treated, the use of prophylactic antibiotics can be important for individual patients. There are, I do want to touch on other malignancies in CLL or patients with SLL. It is important to recognize that this is an increased, seen an increased frequency. And recent reports from a multiplicity of centers have included not only skin, but now prostate, breast, melanoma, gastrointestinal, lung, and other solid tumors. So given that this may be twice the risk for CLL patients, awareness of these are important. The last topic that I want to cover prior to the Q&A is for CLL patients to be aware of really requiring a team that would help to take care of that individual. It should not necessarily just be the hematologist, but we recommend that the hematologist be linked strongly and closely with the general family practitioner, internist, and a dermatologist. However, there is another layer to this, which is something we've looked at fairly intensively and have documented. And this is an aspect that we emphasize to our colleagues here, and that is the impact of physician disease-specific expertise on patient outcome. And for, in particular, CLL patients who are seen by, if you will, a CLL-ologist, it is the case that for individuals who are seeing someone experienced in treating and managing CLL, that there will be significant differences in the median time to first therapy and even in overall survivorship. So I would emphasize as a last point that physician disease-specific expertise does appear to influence outcome in patients with CLL, and to the greatest extent possible, CLL patients should be cared for by a hematologist or oncologist that's expert in the care of their specific malignancy. I think I'll stop there and be happy to answer any questions.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Kay. That was an excellent presentation with a lot of really good information for everybody, and I think that there'll definitely be questions for you also during the Q&A, so thank you so much. And our next speaker is Megan Gutierrez. She is a Chief Communications Officer with the Lymphoma Research Foundation. And again, I want to thank Megan and also Brian Tomlinson for playing a key role in actually orchestrating today's program. And Megan is going to address the free support services, programs, and conferences offered by the Lymphoma Research Foundation. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Ms. Gutierrez.
Thank you, Carolyn, and Cancer Care for this continued partnership. Thank you to our esteemed faculty, Drs. Chesson and Kay, for taking time to be with us today and for all that you do for the Lymphoma Research Foundation and people affected by lymphoma. I would also like to acknowledge Genentech, Biogen, IDEC, and Gilead for supporting today's call. The Lymphoma Research Foundation is the nation's largest nonprofit organization devoted exclusively to funding innovative lymphoma research and providing people with lymphoma and healthcare professionals with up-to-date information about this type of cancer. LRF's mission is to eradicate lymphoma and serve those touched by this disease. LRF invests millions of dollars each year to combat lymphoma and assist those whose lives have been affected by a lymphoma diagnosis. The foundation remains dedicated to identifying a cure through an aggressively funded research program and to helping members of the lymphoma community by providing comprehensive disease-specific programs and services. To date, LRF has funded more than $54 million in lymphoma-specific research. This includes over $3 million for CLL research. Over 60,000 people are served each year by LRF programs. LRF provides a comprehensive series of programs and services for people dealing with a diagnosis of lymphoma and their caregivers, including the Lymphoma Helpline, where our professional staff can assist you in your search for information, resources, and other support materials, a clinical trials information service to assist you in your search for clinical trials. The Lymphoma Support Network is a national one-to-one peer support program that matches lymphoma patients or caregivers with volunteers who have had similar lymphoma-related experiences. Print and web-based publications and newsletters are also available, including comprehensive disease guides, disease-specific fact sheets, and informational e-newsletters. Webcasts and podcasts are available on specific types of lymphoma, treatment options, and support topics. Focus on CLL, our dedicated website for CLL, offers disease and treatment information. That URL is focusonCLL.org. You can visit the site and sign up today to receive news and LRF CLL disease-specific e-newsletters. In-person patient education conferences are available on the local, regional, and national level. And last but not least, our new mobile app, Focus on Lymphoma. Focus on Lymphoma is the first mobile application for smartphones and tablets that provides patients and caregivers comprehensive content based upon their lymphoma subtype, including CLL, and tools to help manage their diagnosis and treatment. The app allows users to record doctor sessions, manage medications, keep track of blood work results, and document treatment side effects. For more information on any of these materials, please contact the Lymphoma Research Foundation at 800-500-9976 or visit our website, lymphoma.org.
Thank you so much, Ms. Gutierrez, for just a wonderful presentation about that. A wonderful, the Lymphoma Research Foundation is a wonderful resource. And if anyone here has not contacted them for help or support, it's just a great resource for you. And I would very much encourage you to contact them. And if you have contacted them, they're just a wonderful place to call when you have questions about anything lymphoma-related, absolutely. Thank you. And our next speaker is Sarah Kelly, and Ms. Kelly is an oncology social worker at Cancer Care. And Ms. Kelly is going to address the free psychosocial support services and groups offered by Cancer Care. Ms. Kelly?
Thank you, Carolyn. I'd also like to thank everyone on the call today. I think we've got a lot of great information. As Carolyn said, I'm an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care, and I work with many people coping with CLL and their loved ones. I want to begin by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer and how Cancer Care can be a part of that network. There are really a lot of ways we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care's programs include individual counseling, which we provide face-to-face in the New York City area and then over the telephone nationally. We also provide support groups face-to-face in the New York area, over the telephone, and also online nationally. We provide education about resources. We can assist you to navigate the healthcare system, provide practical help, and also some limited financial assistance, as well as chemotherapy copay assistance. All our services are provided by licensed master's-level oncology social workers, and they are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends. They're also trained to help cancer patients and their families tackle the problems that accompany the disease, such as financial demands, physical changes, social adjustment, and psychological impact and care. Adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is really an important part of the healing process. As you may know, cancer affects the whole person and their family, loved ones, really the support network. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. You do not have to walk the path alone. I really can't stress that enough. Joining a support group is a way where you can connect with others who are going through a similar situation or having similar problems. And individual counseling really provides a space that's just yours to voice any concerns you may be having. I think these connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. Feeling well emotionally can help you better deal with a diagnosis and treatment. If you're interested in any of Cancer Care's services, please call our Hope Line at 1-800-813-HOPE, and that's 1-800-813-4673. You can also visit our website at www.cancercare.org. Our website is very comprehensive, and you can find a lot of additional information on your diagnosis and treatment there. As we've learned from today's program, there's a lot of information to digest. There's a lot to get your arms around. Our social workers can also help you understand what it means for you and your family. Your social worker can help you prioritize, and if you need to rehearse questions that you may have for the medical team to get the answers and information you need, we can help with that. Please remember you're not alone in this. Cancer Care Services are here to help you. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to talk to you today.
Oh, thank you very much, Sarah. That wonderful, very wonderful presentation about our services and just giving everyone just a highlight of what they can expect in calling us. And Sarah is one of our oncology social workers here, so you have a sense of how impassioned and caring they are in terms of the services. And now we have time for questions, and we have lots of time for questions. So I'm going to ask Stephanie to bring all of our speakers on board. And if you would explain to the audience, Stephanie, how to queue up for questions, and then we'll take as many of the questions as possible.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question comes from Robert V.L. Your line is open.
Hello. Unfortunately, during the conference, our telephone system went dead. Could someone please give me a quick recap of someone mentioned ABT-199, please?
And also just because you didn't hear the beginning of the call, and for those of you who want to listen to the call again, let me give you that information. And these calls are on telephone replay and also on replay on the website as well. So you would simply call 1-800-625-5288 and give the code of 1621309. So I will ask our speaker to just address your basic question. It's always good for us to all hear that again. But just in case you missed a lot of the call and want to hear it, and we can go over that with you after the call as well. Dr. Chesson, would you want to address that question?
Sure. ABT-199 is an oral drug which targets a protein called BCL2. Which is involved in the programmed cell death pathway of the CLL cells. So it activates the cell's ability to die. As I mentioned, it's oral. It is in clinical trials. It is very effective, notably in patients with the 17p deletion, probably the worst of all prognostic features. But it is in clinical trials as a single agent and also in combination with bendamustine and rituximab. So more to follow. The preliminary results are very exciting, with the response rates to the single agent up in the range of 70%, and the responses occur very quickly with this drug.
Excellent. Thank you. And our next question is from one of our online participants, Herbert, and the question is, for people who have been in long remissions and are in their 70s, what options for treatment are effective once there is a relapse? Dr. Kay, could you address that question?
Yes. So for individuals who are over the age of 70, the actual median age for CLL is 72. We consider that for fit CLL patients, that is, patients who have no serious organ problems, organic functions such as cardiovascular, renal, liver aspects, that they could definitely, if they're fit, go on perhaps our gold standard treatment of FCR again if they did get a durable response to the original chemoimmunotherapy approach. And by that I mean at least 5 years, let's say, or 6 years, where they did get a very, very durable response. It wouldn't be unreasonable to repeat it. However, as Dr. Chestnut has pointed out, there are alternatives. Again, if they're fit, bendamustine, rituximab could be an approach with or without other investigational agents. There is the possibility of, for certain individuals who've been treated, to go on a high-dose steroid with rituximab combination, which does have its own toxicities, but can be used to treat a difficult relapse refractory disease. There are clinical trials that are coming out, as we reviewed, particularly the oral signal inhibitors that look like they can be used without significant bone marrow or immune suppression that would theoretically be kinder and gentler. And then finally, I guess I would mention the use of lenalidomide, which is a drug that can be given orally and can be used in low dose, alone or in combination. And there have been some recent publications suggesting that it's effective in the elderly. So there is a growing menu for those individuals and certainly some treatment options. It is much more limited for individuals who are not fit, however.
Thank you. And our next question, Stephanie, from one of our telephone participants.
Our next question comes from Michael M. Your line is open.
Oh, hello. I've been diagnosed with the chromosome 12 trisomy, and my platelets have been dropping. And I was just wondering, I'm 64 years old, and if you're able to, what type of a treatment might you recommend? And will that treatment have the effect of increasing my platelets again, or will they stay low?
Okay, well, Michael, thank you. That's an excellent question, so thank you for your question. And, of course, what I'm going to ask our speakers to do is address your question in a general way, and then we do encourage you then, of course, to go back to your treating physician, of course, and bring the information to them and really ask more specifically. So, Dr. Chesson, would you like to first begin by addressing this? And I think I'll ask both you and Dr. Kay to address it if you wish. So, Dr. Chesson, would you go first?
Sure. There are two common reasons why the platelet count can be low in patients with CLL. The first of these, and the most common, is that the disease is more heavily infiltrating the bone marrow and is preventing population by normal blood elements. But we also commonly see is an entity called immune thrombocytopenia, where in CLL, antibodies are developed which are directed against the platelets and kill them. And the best way to distinguish between these two entities, which are treated very differently, is to do a bone marrow test. This will show you whether the platelets are being made or whether they are being prevented from being made. And the treatment is different because if it's related to the CLL, then we tend to treat the CLL. If it's related to immune thrombocytopenia, then simpler methods can be considered, such as a short course of corticosteroids or prednisone, something along that line. There are other drugs, if that doesn't work, such as intravenous immunoglobulins. Rituximab can also work in that setting. So it's important to distinguish between the disease-related thrombocytopenia and the immune-mediated thrombocytopenia.
Thank you. And Dr. Kay, did you want to add anything? Or?
No, I think Dr. Jessen covered that very nicely.
Excellent. Okay. Thank you. Excellent. And our next question, Stephanie?
Our next question comes from Nadine G. Your line is open.
Yes, hello. I finished my second round of chemo in June. It was more gentle than the first one with Rituxan. And I just want to know, I feel tired. I don't know if it's psychological. I'm fit now, and I just want to know what your views are.
Well, that's an excellent question, Nadine, and it's an important one. Again, I'm going to ask our speakers to address this in a general way, and then we'll have you go back to your treating healthcare team to tease out all the specifics for you in particular. But I'm going to ask Dr. Kay to address that question, if you would, Dr. Kay, please.
Yes, in a general way, because I don't know the specifics of the second round, but I'm assuming that was completion of a multiple course of a particular approach, and fatigue is not uncommon, especially where it's a chemo-immunotherapy combination with appearing nucleosides such as fludarabine along with cyclophosphamide. Rituximab, if patients are experiencing significant anemia, that can definitely occur. There is a peculiar prolonged effect for some patients with chemoimmunotherapy where they, even though they're entering into excellent remissions, they may still have some fatigue that may last for some time, but ultimately may go away. I think you need to be a little bit patient if you're close to the therapy. Hopefully that fatigue will ameliorate, disappear, be somewhat more tolerable, but we need to make sure it's not related to a toxicity of the therapy, such as a drop in your hemoglobin.
Excellent. So we definitely recommend, Nadine, that you take this information, take it back to your treating healthcare team, as Dr. Kay has said, so they can make it more specific to your particular situation. Excellent. We have a question from one of our online participants. What is the best treatment for CLL, for someone with CLL who was previously treated with FCR and now needs treatment again? Dr. Chesson, would you address that question?
Sure. As Neil said earlier, some of that depends on how long the initial response was. If it was a year or two, we wouldn't use FCR again. In fact, in older patients over 65, we tend not to use it at all. In fact, I don't use it myself. I use BR. For patients who have progressed after FCR, what should be considered the standard of care is a clinical trial, because you can get one of these new exciting drugs, whether it be ibrutinib, idelalisib, ABT-199, GS-99-70, all these things with letters and numbers are out there. They're all pills. They're all effective. And right now in a clinical trial, they're free. But if you don't have access or are not eligible for clinical trial, the standard treatment for patients who have progressed after an FCR-like regimen would be bendamustine rituximab. If, for some reason, that doesn't work, or it's not available, or you're not considered suitable by your primary physician, then other therapies out there include an antibody called ofatumumab, which is similar to rituximab, although it binds to a different part of that protein CD20 on the cell surface than does rituximab. But it's also an active treatment. It is, however, intravenous and requires repeated administrations. So clinical trial first, bendamustine, rituximab, and ofatumumab. The other drug that was also mentioned by Neil was lenalidomide or Revlimid, which is also active in patients who have relapsed or refractory CLL. Clinical trial is still number one on the list.
Excellent. Thank you. And our next question, Stephanie?
Our next question comes from Stephanie F. Your line is open.
Yes, I have a double-pronged question about low immunoglobulins. First of all, is there a cutoff level number that you can tell me? And secondly, I think Dr. Kay it was that mentioned that the infusions for immunoglobulin were controversial. Could you tell me what is the controversy, please?
Cool. Thank you for those two questions, and I'm going to ask Dr. Kay to address them again in a general way, and we'll have you then go back to your treating healthcare team. Dr. Kay?
Yes, thank you. That's an important question and one that's not so easy to answer absolutely with clear guidelines. But it is. There are three immunoglobulins, IgG, A, and M. They're easily measurable. The standard normal ranges are available for individual laboratories. They're not always exactly the same. Peculiar but true. So if a CLL patient has, I guess the most dramatic and clear situation would be repeated bacterial infections, pneumonia, sepsis, bladder infections, whatever, that requires hospitalization, that are severe infections associated with lowering of all three, usually most hematologists would try to have that individual go on monthly intravenous gamma globulin. And there's a standard dose that's used. And if there is an associated reduction in the bacterial infections, then it works. The controversy is that there isn't really a solid clinical trial that has proven definitively that it makes a difference. So we tend to go by individual patient outcome. With respect to whether there's one lowered immunoglobulin, let's just say it's just IgA or just IgM, again, if it's low, and there is repeated bacterial infections that are reduced with the regular use of infusional IgG, then that usually is given. So it's not a perfect answer, but it's the best that we can do at this time.
Excellent. Thank you. And we have a question from one of our online participants, Lisa. I'm in my late 40s. How should I expect my life with CLL to be different than older patients? So I think I'll ask both. Dr. Chesson, would you want to start with that question?
Well, that's difficult without knowing more about the individual person. For a patient who has early stage disease and doesn't require treatment, then their life should be, we tell patients to lead a normal life. Do what you want, eat what you want, drink what you want, get exercise like you should, etc. For patients who require treatment, they tend to tolerate treatment better than older persons. And, you know, a regimen like FCR would be better tolerated by a younger person than someone over 65, for example. Older people tend to have comorbidities, as Neil Kay outlined, and therefore treatments may be a bit more challenging. But basically, it's the stage of the disease and it's the fitness of the person that tells us more about how to manage them and how they are likely to do than it is just having the disease itself.
Excellent. Thank you. So that's really important then to go back to your treating team and identify all those factors so that you can go on with your life, which is the most important thing with appropriate medical care and supervision. We have another question from one of our online participants from Barton. Have the following shown, and Dr. Kay, I think you had addressed this in part, but have the following shown any assistance to slowing the growth of CLL? Green tea and antioxidants. I have been moved to stage one and use of many of these products, and they do not seem to help. So just wanted to, if you could answer that in a general way, Dr. Kay, in terms of...
Yes. So I'll answer that based on our own studies, which were phase 1-2 studies using epigallocatechin or EGCG. This was provided to us in its purest form and actually was provided to us through the government sort of flow going through an entity called the FDA and CTEP. So we knew exactly what this was, and we gave increasing doses of this epigallocatechin, which is the major component of green tea, to a cohort of early-stage patients. And about a third of these individuals did get sustained reductions in their total lymphocyte count and also in their lymph node status. So we know that you can generate, if you will, somewhat of a response. These are not complete responses. There is no data to suggest that these products would delay a progression to first therapy. That's something we're interested in doing. I have to say that we cannot continue to do this because the only company in the world that was producing EGCG has turned its attention elsewhere. There are one final quick comment. There are over-the-counter products that say they contain epigallocatechin, but they're not FDA approved, and so even if you get them, you don't know exactly what you're taking.
Excellent, thank you. Now, I want to thank all of our speakers. This has been an extraordinary call. I also want to thank all of you who have queued up and asked such great questions, both on the telephone and online. And I want to thank you all of you who have been listening as well. Now, I do want to remind everyone this is a one-hour workshop, and that in planning a program like this, we recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. So with that in mind, I just want to remind all of you that you have access to the Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care at the end of this call with any questions you didn't get to ask. Although we did take a number of your questions, we did not take everyone's question. We could go on all day, and that would be that wouldn't be fair to all of you in terms of the time. So what I would encourage you to do is to go ahead and actually call us, either the Lymphoma Research Foundation at 1-800-500-9976, or contact Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE. Either of those calls would actually work very well in terms of, you know, accessing, services or answers to your questions. Most importantly, as we conclude our program today, I don't want anyone to think that you're alone in coping with CLL or with cancer in general. I want you to know that you're part of the supportive network here, and that we're all here to help you, and we're simply all a phone call away. So again, I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect and have a wonderful day.